You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire Wharahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. Ewhai akane, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the government's recent energy reforms and about the three New Zealanders aboard the global Sunward flotilla who have been incepted by Israel. On Friday, I spoke to the National President of the Tertiary Education Union, or TEU, Julie Douglas, about the University of Auckland, Massey University, and the Victoria University of Wellington, all announcing they will not be using software to detect AI in students' work and what this means heading forward. Following my chat with Douglas, I spoke to Sharpa Richter, a senior marketing lecturer at the University of Auckland, about using interactive oral assessments, or IOAs, as a way to combat AI in testing students. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to doctoral candidate at the University of Auckland, Luke Burrard, about his concerns around sports washing with the FIFA World Cup in 2026 in the United States in the midst of human rights concerns under the Trump administration.
Here are ho whakaaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e ware ware e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei apakihiri rokiroki mā rongi te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
On Wednesday, the government announced new energy reforms in its energy package. This follows a review into the sector being undertaken by Frontier Economics. Despite this, the government has decided not to follow a significant amount of recommendations within the review. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I spoke to Court about this package and some of the backlash the government has received from the sector regarding it. We also discussed Samuel Leeson, Rana Hamida and Yosef Samoa being detained in Israel by attempting to deliver aid into Gaza. The interception of these vessels is illegal under international law, as the interceptions took place in the Mediterranean Sea between 70 to 80 nautical miles off the Gazan coast. This comes a month after over 100 humanitarian groups have signed an open letter calling for Israel to allow essential aid into the besieged Gaza Strip. They say they are not authorized to deliver aid unless they comply with tough Israeli measures. I also spoke to Court about the three New Zealand detainees and what the government is doing to get them home. But first, we discussed energy reforms. What is the aim of these energy reforms?
Well, the energy market conditions have got progressively worse since 2018. It's putting Kiwis out of work as manufacturing businesses close, forcing households to choose between keeping the lights and heaters on or paying other bills. So the changes that we've announced are intended to provide confidence to the market to invest in what matters, rather than completely upend it like some commentators have called for. And just for a bit of background, much of the blame for high power prices rests in the lack of firming options for investors who want to bring cheaper renewables into the market but were struggling to get a contract for gas and coal backup, because when the wind doesn't blow, we have a dry year, obviously at night you can't get solar energy. These renewable investors still need firm electricity. So one of the things we've done is we've said, look, if these gentailers want to bring a proposal to the government to invest in gas and coal, then the government will look very kindly on supporting that investment. We've said go out to the market, you know, place equity in the market. In other words, go and offer shares to new investors. The government will match that. And, you know, just a range of other changes to the regulatory regime to make it easier to invest.
The government has essentially rejected 8 of the 10 recommendations in the Frontier Review, including 5 of the report's main recommendations. Why is this?
Well, some of the recommendations, like selling the existing gentailer shares that the government holds and investing it in a coal-fired power station, seem to be a bit of a moonshot, frankly, and unlikely to deliver the outcomes that Kiwis need. And also, if you think about how the government's scarce capital should be allocated, you know, if we are going to liberate that lazy capital from the gentailer assets the Crown owns, we need to put up an investment case, you know, for a coal-fired power station, say, against other already identified investment needs like hospitals, schools, you know, defence accommodation for our Defence Force personnel living in really old, you know, grotty homes, and, of course, roads, highways and transport. So, you know, it didn't make any sense for the government to be selling electricity assets to put them into a coal-fired power station. Now, that's a decision for another day, when probably for the next government.
You've mentioned some that this package has received some criticism from the sector. The Auckland Business Forum has called the announcement a missed opportunity, with the major electricity users group's John Harbund saying there is nothing in this that's going to make a difference to affordability in the next decade. He said this on RNZ's 9 to Noon. Why do you think these groups are maybe a little bit disappointed by these announcements?
Well, I've met with both of those groups, and I do understand their perspective. However, we need to balance it against other objectives, and that is long-term stability. The previous government had a project they were cooking up called the Lake Onslow Dam, and that was to be maybe a $10 or $15 billion project that itself was going to take a decade or two to build in the South Island. And while that project was on the books, the private sector was just not prepared to invest in new generation that essentially might be sterilised by a government mega project. So we've taken that off the books. We've also said, in terms of security for investors, the government is going to underwrite sovereign risk. In other words, the contracts that we're prepared to enter into are going to recognise very clearly that if a future government comes along and tears up the contract, there's a cost to that future government. Whereas, you know, in the past, you know, the previous government, that tore up the ability for companies to go and explore for the next oil and gas field. And remember, the next one is literally on the other side of a line on a map. They're right there. They're available now to be drilled into. They tore up that opportunity, you know, where people had, you know, if not banked on, at least had some certainty about where they were going next with their energy investment. So I understand the concerns, but we are restoring certainty to the market. And there's some other stuff we've done, which I know that John Harbord and others would be pleased with. We've put resource management consenting for thermal energy, that's coal and gas-fired power station, on the same one-year priority pathway that renewables get. So what it means is, if one of the gentailers or if a Contact Energy or a new entrant to the market turns up and says, we want to build a gas peaker and next year, you know what? They can go and apply for the consent and it has to be issued within 12 months. That's going to give a huge amount of certainty to their investors. So there's a lot more happening in the government's approach to the energy sector than just in last week's announcement. And I think that once all of these changes settle and people become familiar with them, they'll feel a lot more confident about where we're heading.
In an ACT Party press release, you say, and I quote, "We're removing bureaucratic and regulatory barriers that have made energy projects costly or unfeasible, whether it's hydro, gas, wind, geothermal, solar, or even one day nuclear. A new resource management system will make it easier to build." I want to touch on the even one day nuclear part there. Would the ACT Party consider bringing back nuclear energy to Aotearoa shores?
Well, if we had even had nuclear energy, we could bring it back. But it's one of those technologies that New Zealand was never in a position to take advantage of when that technology was new. But now, when you look around the world at the small to medium nuclear reactors, you know, these things can be installed out the back of a factory, you know, on an industrial site and power industry. It's something that we're going to need to be open to in the near future, is this technology, which is essentially resilient to all kinds of hazards. We're going to have to be open to looking at options like that. Now, I doubt very much whether that's something we're going to need in the next decade, but we need to make sure that our planning system, our environmental management system, yeah, is is up to the introduction of these new kind of technologies.
For our second topic, three New Zealanders, Samuel Leeson, Rana Hamida and Yosef Samoa, have been detained by Israel following the three attempting to deliver essential aid to Gaza on the global Sumud flotilla. What are the government doing to get these three back to the country?
Well, the government has sent a representative to meet with these three individuals who are currently banged up in Israel, because they tried to break a naval blockade of Hamas-controlled Gaza, a blockade that's been in place since 2008. What turns out, for very good reasons, because Hamas were planning to and did attack Israel and kill and kidnap civilians on October 7, 2023, and that's 2 years ago tomorrow. Obviously, thank goodness, it sounds like Hamas are almost defeated and may even agree to release the remaining hostages this week. But, you know, as far as these three individuals are concerned, yeah, they will get the kind of consular and diplomatic support that New Zealand can extend to its citizens wherever they are around the world. But, you know, let's be clear, sailing into a war zone is not a smart idea, and MFAT does not have a regular diplomatic presence in Israel. And so I know they'll do their best, but, you know, like the Prime Minister said, we've confirmed with Israel we expect our citizens to be treated in accordance with the law, but, you know, we don't have any other information at this time.
That kind of touches on a little bit of my next question here, but Leeson's dad, Adi Leeson, says the 18-year-old and the other detainees have been, and I quote, have been zip-tied with their hands behind their back and forced to kneel for 5 hours, no water provided, and no toilet facilities and no medical care, and that there's 11 people in one cell, so they're sort of crammed in there, following British diplomats speaking with Samuel. These are quite concerning claims. Has the government been in contact with anyone directly who has been able to verify the conditions these activists are being held in?
Well, I understand that one of New Zealand's consular partners in Tel Aviv met with the detained New Zealanders and provided support on Friday to them. But we won't be commenting further on individuals' cases for privacy reasons. But I just want to also point out that these individuals have gone and tried to break a naval blockade, and their claims of wanting to deliver aid to Gaza just don't stack up. Around 2 million tonnes of aid has been delivered into Gaza over the past 2 years. A single truck can carry around 25 tonnes. So it's hard to see this flotilla they were participating in carrying a few tonnes of aid as anything but a stunt and an opportunity for selfies. So I'm sure they'll have time to reflect while they're in Israeli detention on whether the stunt has been worth it. But in the meantime, I'm confident that the New Zealand Ministry for Foreign Affairs and Trade is doing all that it needs to support these individuals.
And when can we expect these three to return to the country?
Well, again, I don't have that information, and the government won't be talking about these individuals to protect their own privacy. But I would expect, you know, if it's anything like how we saw Greta Thunberg treated the last time she participated in a flotilla and in one of these stunts, you know, she spent a little bit of time there, time for reflection. She was given the sandwich and then given a free flight home. So I'm sure it won't be too long.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the government's energy reforms and what the government is doing to get Samuel Leeson, Rana Hamida and Yosef Samoa home. We'll be right back. Text 53095 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Let me dance away forever, baby.
That was Forgotten Eyes by Big Thief, and before that was Cobra by Geese. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
Over the last few months, concerns have been raised over the hosting of the 2026 FIFA World Cup in the United States, particularly concerns over human rights in the country, visa worries, and accusations of sports washing have been increasingly levied towards the country. The relative lack of coverage of these concerns, comparatively to concerns over the previous tournament in Qatar or those in the future in countries like Saudi Arabia, complicate the history that football and FIFA have with questionable regimes and funding. Despite the Trump administration's policies that seem to threaten the tournament, there continues to be a lack of noise around whether or not the three host countries should be reduced to two, removing the US. I spoke to doctoral candidate at the University of Auckland, Luke Bird, about the sports washing, its background, and why the US and countries like Qatar are treated differently. Amnesty International have expressed serious concerns over the state of human rights in the US for the tournament. What specifically are we seeing?
Yeah, I think rightly people have concerns around what's going on in the US, particularly around anti-immigration, anti-democracy rhetoric. It seems like the US is moving towards more kind of authoritarian thinking in its policy, things around, the deportation of long-settled migrants, lawful residents, and even US citizens. You know, we've seen so many ICE raids. Trump has either deployed or threatened to deploy the National Guard in often democratic cities. And then, we're also seeing concerns around the press being silenced, public service broadcasting being defunded, the same with academic institutions, even comedians recently. So I think rightly in the US, press is a concern that the country is slowly sliding towards authoritarianism.
The tournament itself has been highlighted as an example of sports washing. What is sports washing and how does it work to rehabilitate the image of Trump or the US administration?
Yeah, it's an interesting one with sports washing. Typically, it describes the practices of states using close associations to sport, usually through hosting events or sponsoring teams, acquiring prominent clubs or teams. And the thinking goes that these kind of repeated close associations to sport serve to legitimize the investing state or distract from domestic issues, normally human rights abuses. There's very little empirical evidence yet to suggest that this does happen. And, sport has been used by Western, non-Western, liberal and illiberal states for a long time as a tool of political persuasion dating back right to ancient Greece. In terms of the American example, it's really interesting because most sports washing criticism has been leveled at authoritarian states in the Persian Gulf. So you think about Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the UAE. And a lot of the criticism centers around its undemocratic nature of these states or the authoritarianism or the widespread human rights abuses. Now, given that this is appearing to happen in the US, Western liberal democracy, it'd be interesting to see whether the sports washing criticism is the same for a Western liberal democracy as it has been in recent years for more authoritarian regimes in the Persian Gulf.
I mean, you've mentioned it there, but have we seen any similarities, or do you think we will see similarities in that criticism, or are we going to continue to see a discrepancy?
Oh, it's a really good question that I'm really, really curious to find out when the event happens. It's also important to stress here, actually, that sports washing criticism has largely emanated from the West at states in the global South or non-Western, however you prefer to call them. And so there's this kind of, it has this ideological or moral lens to it. There's lots of normative language used, stating basically what shouldn't and should be done as it relates to sport. I don't know yet whether sports washing discourse will be the same for the US, although I imagine it will be higher than, for example, London 2012, given that it's more accepted as terminology in sports journalism at the moment. But my expectation is that given that it's a Western liberal democracy. I think sports washing accusations will be far less than, for example, Qatar 2022.
In September, The Athletic reported that FIFA had received 145 reports of human rights concerns at the just-gone Club World Cup in the US. How does this kind of ground the US and, in particular, hosting of these tournaments in these human rights abuses?
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting question. And I think the Club World Cup was another example where Trump, became the centre of the spectacle, as it were. And, you know, we've seen it this year at the US Open, the Ryder Cup, the Super Bowl. During the Daytona NASCAR race, he flew Air Force One around the circuit and then did a tour of the circuit in the presidential limo. So we know that Trump's going to become front and centre of anything related to spectacle in the US. He's quite masterful at stealing the headlines. Insofar as the World Cup is concerned, I think similarly to what people have talked about for the 2002 Salt Lake City Winter Olympics, I think the US will try to position its, essentially peacock its security and wealth credentials. I think the event will be used to stoke nationalism as it has been done at lots of other sports mega events. I think we'll see a lot of self-celebrating or self-aggrandizement from Trump and the US government. How they deflect from or distract from domestic social problems and the human rights abuses discussed, really difficult to tell at this stage. And that there's, as I say, very little empirical evidence to suggest that heavy investment in these sports events can distract from these types of moral violations.
Reportedly, the US State Department has denied the Iranian delegation visas for the World Cup draw in December. Is this a sort of bleed of authoritarian policy maybe into the tournament that we might continue to see?
Yeah, I definitely think that's something to watch out for. Earlier this year, the US government implemented its travel ban on, I think it was 40 countries at the time, and immediately questions were raised about the fact that they're hosting the World Cup and then the 2028 Olympics in LA 2 years later. And, you know, for example, at the Paris Olympics last year, there were delegates from every single country on the travel ban list. There have been exemptions made for players, staff and families to attend these events, but not for fans. So there's going to be huge visa issues around both events for fans wanting to attend. So, for example, I believe it's Colombia at the moment has a 2-year wait list for visas. The same with Turkey. Now, given that Colombia only recently qualified, it's less than 2 years away, so it seems almost impossible for these fans to be able to attend. I think when you also factor in that the event held over three different countries, the visa complications are going to be absolutely massive. I think if your team are to qualify into Group K, for example, you will have group stage games in the US and then Mexico and then back in the US. And if you qualify for the knockouts, you then have to travel to Canada and back. So some of these have less than 3 or 4 days notice for being able to apply for a visa. So it seems like there's going to be massive complications. And as yet, how this is all going to be resolved in the US is unclear.
A lot of criticism towards sports washing and just general corruption in sports does get levied towards FIFA. What role do FIFA play in enabling the sports washing, especially in the case of the FIFA World Cup with both Qatar and now the US?
I think when people first started talking about sports washing, it was largely a criticism of the investing state. And then over a few years, people came to realise that, okay, hang about. You know, these states aren't making these investments in a vacuum. There's got to be an element of, it's got to be a kind of two-way street, as it were. So FIFA has been actively looking for investment from authoritarian states for years, dating back to, you know, Mussolini and I think it was the 1928 World Cup through to Argentina in 1978. And more recently, you know, some of the biggest sponsors are brands owned by authoritarian regimes, Saudi Aramco, Qatar Airways, etc. Most of its Club World Cup hosts in recent years have been authoritarian states accused of sports washing, you know, the UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, etc. And yet, many of its host events for its kind of flagship men's tournaments, the World Cup and the FIFA Club World Cup in recent years, have been hosted by states accused of sports washing. And critics, scholars, largely say that this is a kind of bi-directional relationship between the investing state and a sporting body like FIFA, who are essentially facilitating and enabling the process of sports washing. And this kind of relationship serves to legitimise the investing state.
And with that said, are we likely to see anything from FIFA in terms of these concerns about the US hosting the tournament?
I think FIFA like to talk a lot about big picture stuff, you know, peace, diplomacy, how football is a force for good around the world. When it comes to actually implementing their own statutes, they seem far more spineless. Interestingly, the 2026 World Cup next year, I think after the controversy surrounding Qatar and Russia, next year's World Cup is the first to incorporate human rights standards in its bidding process. So FIFA's framework includes commitment to support at-risk groups. So I think they state women, ethnic minorities, disabled people, immigrants, refugees and asylum seekers, migrant workers, LGBTQI plus people, and interestingly, journalists. And it's for anyone that follows the news, know that Trump has demonized lots of these different groups. So where FIFA stands on it during the tournament is going to be really, really interesting, because they like to present themselves as high and mighty around these things, but they rarely actually follow through on their own commitments and statutes. Yeah, I think what's going to be really, really interesting in the US over the next two sports mega events is that they're both designated as National Special Security Events, so NSSEs. So events of huge international significance. Usually these are only kind of military parades, sports mega events in the US. And here the US Secret Service leads the planning and security measures. So this triggers involvement from federal agencies, and that includes Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. So LA 2028, it's NSSE, has already been in place since last year, meaning that ICE will already be having some role in security and policing the event in LA way before it actually happens. And given that LA is one of the cities in the US with the highest number of migrants, I think it's going to be, yeah, pretty worrying to see ICE policing and implementing security measures for that. Something this kind of, I think there are genuine concerns about unlawful imprisonment, deportations, the kind of forced displacement of communities, including unhoused people in LA. I think these are genuine concerns that news media should be following closely and reporting on, definitely.
That was the University of Auckland's Luke Bird on sports washing at the 2026 FIFA World Cup and what it means for the US.
Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
Ah!
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
95 BFM presents the Saints 73-78, making their New Zealand debut at the Power Station Friday, October 31. Get ready to have your senses pummeled by punk pioneers Ed Cooper, Ivor Hay, Mick Harvey, Mark Arm, and Peter Oxley. A once-in-a-lifetime gig. It's the Saints 73-78 live at the Power Station Friday, October 31. Tickets available now from plusone.co.nz.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive. Thanks to the Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Are you a freak? Do you like slugs? Then boy, do we have the band for you.
Are you an honest
freak slug from Manchester is heading to New Zealand. If you have a B card, you could win a double pass to the show. Just stay tuned to Morning Glory for your chance to win. Freak Slug at the Tuning Fork, October 21st. Get your tickets now from thetuningfork.co.nz.
I'm not on the job.
Yes, I am. The rhythm selection, you know. Every Monday night from 9 till 11, Dubbed and Bass Selectors play the full range of ghetto sound. Yeah, man. From rock steady to roots reggae, beat bam sound to hip hop, dub style, true to the latest dancehall vibes. Yeah, man. The rhythm selection. Boy, the rhythm selection. Why? The rhythm selection. Boy, from 9 to 11 and 95 FM. Dub it up, yes, selectors. The rhythm selection.
Better than ever.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. That was Better Than Ever by Roy Irwin.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Recently, the University of Auckland, Massey University and the Victoria University of Wellington have announced they will not be using software to check over students' work for AI plagiarism. This has left concerns over what the future of checking for AI will mean in these universities and whether other universities and tertiary institutions as a whole will follow suit. On Friday, I spoke to the National President of the Tertiary Education Union, or TEU, Julie Douglas, about this announcement and the union's thoughts on it. Why are we seeing these universities moving away from using software to check for AI in students' work?
Look, I think this is a dynamic problem which is moving at such pace that many institutions are just at a loss to know how to deal with it. We know with AI, the whole point of it is that it learns. And so every time I think things get in place to try and monitor or identify any breaches, it learns how to get around that and won't do it the next time. So I think we are under attack by these new tools that we have in our world, which are challenging a lot of areas of integrity in education. And I'm curious to see that the university take those positions. I know that Massey, for instance, has decided to go back into in-person exams at the end of semesters, which is really the only way that you can assure that students' work is their own. Yes, so I just think it's a reality of this crazy world we live in.
How prolific is the usage of AI in our universities, especially since we've seen such a rise in it in recent years?
Look, I can't quantify that. I know anecdotally, and even in my own experience at AUT, there is evidence that students students forever have always looked for ways to get around things of doing the work. This is just a new tool they're using. So I think I don't know exactly how widespread it is, but I think it's significant when the ability of the use of these new tools is going to undermine the credibility of education, and it certainly is undermining the critical thinking skills of students. And we do not want to be having graduates out in the workplace who have not developed those critical thinking skills. So for me, that's what really worries me about this. You know, just usual old plagiarism of cut and pasting out of somebody's article does not have the potential to the same extent to change students' approaches to critical thinking.
Now, the University of Auckland, Massey University and the Victoria University of Wellington are just three of the universities we have in the country. What are we seeing from the other universities here in regards to how they're approaching how students are using AI in their work? Are these universities using AI detection tools still?
Look, I think there's a range, and I think one of the approaches that a number of universities are using is trying to use an educative approach. So getting students to understand how to use the tool, allowing them to use it within certain constraints, having to be explicit in statements that they have used it. But to be honest, while I think it's good to be teaching students the critical ways to use these tools, I'm not sure that we are allowing or educating our teachers in these universities the time and resources to understand the use of AI by students and educating them on how to identify incorrect use of it. And lecturers already are overwhelmed with the burdens of the job, and this further requirement to be the police is quite frustrating and detracts from the point of the university.
That touches on a little bit of my next point, but are you aware if lecturers and academic staff were involved in these decisions at the University of Auckland and these universities at all?
Look, I'm not aware. Look, we're still working on developing our position as a union around the use of AI, but one of the things that we do feel quite strongly about is that just in the same way that health and safety committees get set up and there's an absolute right for worker representation on those committees, we think that there should be similar committees set up within universities which have the stakeholders involved on that to be part of this, because as I said, this is moving so quickly, it is so dynamic. We need the stakeholders involved because everybody's interests are at the heart of this, and we need to be collectively working out what is in the best interests of our graduates. So I think that often the universities are moving quite quickly, but not maybe going through a process which involves all stakeholders, and that worries me.
And is the union concerned that with these universities announcing that they will be moving away from using software to check over students' work for AI, that this might incentivize students to, maybe even students who haven't used AI in coursework previously, to now start using AI?
Oh God, I hope not. Look, I hope most students, I mean, I know there are so many pressures on students' time now, but I would really hope that most students would appreciate that if they are spending so much money and time to get this qualification, that they embrace the process of learning and indulge in that process and go about their work and their assignments trying to learn and understand and find out rather than pushing a button. But, you know, we will never stop students, the few students who do take that choice. But I think we just have to trust that in the long term, they won't be getting the top jobs. They won't be having those positions because they won't have developed those skills which will get them into good work.
And this next question's a little bit broad, but with what barriers, and you have briefly touched on this as well, but what barriers are in place to make sure students aren't plagiarising their work with AI? You mentioned Massey going back to in-person exams at the end of the semester. What are we seeing at other universities?
I think, you know, a greater requirement for disclosure. And I know that, well, it feels to me that, you know, if you go into any university, there isn't a standard approach across every faculty and every department. So I think it also depends a little bit on the content and what you're dealing with, because some subjects won't lend themselves very well to, well, at this point, maybe the use of AI as widespread as in other places. So I think that wherever there's a deeply rich content, you will have less of a problem. But I think that, you know, lecturers are finding different ways that they may use in-class presentations, or they may require students to have one-on-ones with lecturers to really get to understand whether there has been a development of understanding of content and concepts. But I don't think we have, and it will never be one-size-fits-all. There is never that approach. So I think we don't know the extent of the different ways people are approaching it, which is why we are at that point, I think, in New Zealand, where we need to start bringing people together to understand what the implications of AI is in tertiary education particularly. The union has got a seminar day on the 7th of November, the 31st of October, looking specifically at AI in tertiary education for our members, and I'm hoping for us to actually come out with a position around what we see going forward we need to be doing and how we need to be involved in that. So I think, you know, this is timely, and it may be past the most timely point that we should be looking at this, but we need to get the information so we actually know what we're dealing with.
And what does this move signal heading forward with these universities not using AI software or software to check over AI in students' work?
Look, I don't know, to be honest. It could be the path of least resistance. And as I say, you know, we'll always have a percentage of students who take one way of dealing with their studies and others would never go down that path. And maybe this is just the next event in history that we're encountering in education and kind of sorts itself out. But look, I just do feel quite deeply concerned about the ability for this tool to reduce the need for critical thinking, because if students put in work without looking at it themselves and thinking about whether or not it's right, it's true, or it's even answered what was asked of them, without casting that overview over it, you know, what is the point? What is the point of education? Some days I do despair. I mean, students pay their money, so we just give them a certificate? I don't know. I think we're at a bit of a turning point in how we address these issues, and I just truly believe that if all the parties don't come together to discuss it, we're not going to come out with an approach which is going to meet our needs as a society.
Following on from my chat with Douglas, I spoke to Sharpa Richter, a senior marketing lecturer at the University of Auckland, about using interactive oral assessments, or IOAs, as a way to combat AI in testing students. She has been testing IOAs over the past couple of years in a piece on The Conversation, which she co-authored with the University of Auckland's Patrick Dodd. She says this method of testing is one of the most effective and authentic ways to see what students really know in the age of AI. I spoke to her about this method of testing and what it entails. To start, how do these IOAs operate?
So they operate in two main ways. Either we get students to come in into a small meeting room and there's myself and a moderator, or an examiner and a moderator, and we do them like that. So there's one student to two of us, or we get them to come in groups, but we still ask questions individually, and it doesn't take long. So individual ones are usually around 7 minutes, and if we do them in a group setting, then it's 5 minutes per student.
How would a group setting operate, and why, I guess, do it in a group setting as opposed to just one-on-one with a lecturer?
Yeah, so the group setting came about when we wanted to scale. So initially we had trialed the IOAs with rather a small class, and so we had time and resourcing to do one-on-one. But when we wanted to put it into a class with 200 students, we needed to figure out a way of where we could still, you know, get the individual IOA, but doing it faster in a group setting. So in a group setting, essentially they sit around in a table, and they can bring in notes in terms of their assignment that they're talking about, but no computers, no devices. And it's just a conversation, and they do not have the option of saying, oh, that wasn't my part, which is something that we're trying to override as well, where, you know, we don't want that kind of answer. Everyone's taken part in the group assignment. Everyone's responsible for the project. You should be able to answer a question about any part of the project.
How are lecturers guaranteeing that they are receiving authentic responses from students instead of the students just memorizing responses to certain questions?
Yeah, so we had that in the first time that we ran it. We gave students the questions that we would ask, like written down, these are the questions. And what we found was that students were doing exactly that. They would memorize the answer to this question and to this question. And when they came in and we asked them that question, they gave us a very rote learned answer. And what we've done now is we've moved away from that to more of a Socratic approach, where we ask a very basic question, just what is this concept? And they could have, you know, ChatGPT'd it, but then we delve into it further and we say, okay, and what is your understanding of it in terms of your project or in terms of this case study? And when you have that kind of conversational tone, it becomes very apparent very quickly who knows their project and knows their work and who's just memorized or rote learnt an answer.
How do lecturers prepare for these sort of assessments? Is there much training needed to prepare lecturers to go into IOAs?
Right. So I think the biggest preparation is having a deep discipline knowledge, which most lecturers do, and drawing on that. And so what we do in terms of training is we have new lecturers or new TAs sit in on some IOAs to watch how we ask questions, how we ask follow-up questions, how we bring students back, you know, within the 3 or 5 or 7 minute time boundary that we have. So that's sort of our main training, and just going through, you know, examples of, okay, if you get a one-word answer, what's another way to ask a question to draw out more information?
And why oral assessments specifically? Why not go back to the stock standard written assessments like I did back in high school?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So when I talk about IOAs, I feel that people get caught up in this, oh, so IOAs are going to replace everything. And they're not, right? So these IOAs are not meant to be the only way that we're assessing students. Typically, they make up 30 to 35% of your total grade. The other parts of your grade can be a mixture of other things, video presentations, in-person presentations, written assessments. So it's not meant to be a standalone, this is the only thing that we're doing. It's meant to be complementary to other forms of assessment.
And are you aware if other countries in the other universities in the country are trialing IOAs as well?
Yes, so I am fairly certain that AUT is doing IOAs, and there's probably other universities doing it. I know for sure in Australia they're doing IOAs, and they have been for as long as we have, or even longer. And some of those are scaling up to huge numbers. So some of them are doing IOAs for 400, 500 student classes.
And you've briefly kind of touched on this point. How would this work for students who have disabilities such as a speech impediment or who are deaf? Would there be different testing involved here to make it a bit more of an equitable experience?
That is an excellent question. We have not come across that yet. And when that does happen, I guess we would have conversation as to how we could support those students. What we have had to deal with is English second language students, where they struggle to communicate in English. And what we have found for those students, well, one thing is that, you know, we are by studying at the University of Auckland, it's an English medium university. So at the end of it, you should be able to communicate in English. So it's testing that ability. But then the other thing is that, you know, we're not trying to trip up these students. We scaffold them throughout the semester. Every tutorial or every other tutorial, we give them an opportunity to practice. You know, how would you respond to a question about this part of your assignment? Let's have a one-on-one practice. So we do try and scaffold throughout the semester, so it's not a surprise.
And these trials have been for university students, specifically postgrad, I think, is the trial you've done so far?
So we've trialed them in undergraduate okay. classes as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect. Would this operate differently if you were to trial this with, like, secondary school students?
I don't think so. I think secondary school students should also have this ability to express themselves and to stand up for what they've learnt, and, you know, to be able to express, you know, their learnings and what they can contribute to the project. Yeah.
And looking forward, and you've also briefly touched on this as well, would you want IOAs to be the standard for testing students' knowledge in universities and just in their schooling in general?
Yes, absolutely. I think this is a really, really important part of anyone's learning. And when we work backwards from industry, it's something that you are expected to do almost on a weekly or daily basis, where you have a stand-up with your team and you need to, you know, you often don't have that much time, and you need to be able to give an elevator pitch of, you know, what work you've been doing and why it's important and how you're contributing. And then you've got to present to your team and then to the wider team and to see, you know, to C-suite. And you've really got to be able to be given the opportunity to practice the skill. I think the most important thing that I would like people to remember with IOAs is that it is a vital skill for students to possess. It is something that we need to practice. It is a good way to navigate this world that we find ourselves in, this AI, you know, how can we create AI friendly or resistant assessments? And it's not the only answer. It's just one of them.
That was the Tertiary Education Union's, or TEU's, Julie Douglas and the University of Auckland's Sharpa Richter on multiple universities moving away from using software to check for AI plagiarism and using interactive oral assessments, or IOAs, as a way to authentically test students.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Koira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party's Simon Court, the University of Auckland Luke Bird and Sharpa Richter, and the Tertiary Education Union's Julie Douglas. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95 BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.